Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. That's not how we normally start the show, but Lester Flatt, Earl Scruggs. Ken Burns traces the history of country music in a new 16.5-hour, 8-part documentary series exploring the uniquely American art form. From its deep and tangled roots in ballads, blues, and hymns performed in small settings to its worldwide popularity, Burns highlights how country music evolved over the course of the 20th century as it eventually emerged to become America's music. The series, premiering on WITF-TV September 15th at 8 p.m., answers questions like, what is country music and where did it come from? Through a mix of events and localized multimedia storytelling, the WITF Music Project will extend the reach and impact of country music. We'll highlight its roots in Pennsylvania, featuring untold stories of people in our region who played an important role in the creation of this uniquely American form of musical storytelling. Plus, we'll explore how the genre is thriving and inspiring a new generation of musicians and fans. And that's what brings WITF here to the Gettysburg Bluegrass Festival for a Smart Talk road trip. We'll be here all day today and tomorrow offering preview screenings and talking about our special WITF Music Storyteller Session event coming up September 8th at American Music Theater in Lancaster. More on that later in the program. But first, I'd like to welcome our guests, Rich and Cindy Wickelman, festival directors, and Joe Cornett. I'm going to introduce you as Cindy's father, but he's the original founder of the Gettysburg Bluegrass Festival in 1979. Welcome to the program, and thank you for having us here today.
Thank you, Scott.
Absolutely.
Welcome to Gettysburg.
We've been to Gettysburg many times, but this is a different kind of location, and you know, music isn't really one of those things that we feature so much or focus on Smart Talk. So this is kind of something unique for even for us. And I know we're really going to enjoy it. And I know our audience, we have a small audience with us here today. I want to tell our audience that during a Smart Talk road trip, we don't normally take phone calls, but we do have an audience that can step up to the microphone and ask a few questions if they would like to. Joe, you're kind of our historian since you did found the Gettysburg Bluegrass Festival. How did the festival get its start?
Well, that's a little bit complicated, but I grew up listening to country music. My family was from the South. I grew up in Chester County, Pennsylvania, which was a hotbed of country music back in the 40s,
believe it or not. Not the 40s, but I remember. I'm from Chester County, too.
Okay.
Campbell's Corner in Oxford, there was a country show every Sunday. Remember that?
Sunset Park for the live outdoor shows and the old Fiddler's Picnic at Lenape Park. And, of course, we listened to WSM and the Wheeling Jamboree on the old Philco AM radio. And my dad was a musician. He played banjo and guitar. And my mother's three brothers all played. And the family entertainment back then was to get together at one of the houses and make music. So I kind of grew up with it. Then I got away from it. Elvis hit the scene when I was in high school. And then in college, folk music kind of got my attention. And then after my wife Lil and I bought Granite Hill and built a campground in the 70s, it at some point just occurred to me, we have an ideal place to present my favorite music in a nice outdoor setting. And it went from there.
Well, there had to be a lot more putting it together. You say it's complicated. It seems like this was your passion. This kind of music was your passion. Why bluegrass, though?
Well, bluegrass really is what I listened to as a child and a young adult up until Elvis. The music, the country music in the 1940s and early 50s is so closely related to what we call bluegrass today that it's really nitpicky to distinguish them. There isn't a lot of difference. Mm-hmm. Modern country music is very different, but traditional country and bluegrass, we didn't call it bluegrass back then. When I was growing up, we called it hillbilly music. We didn't distinguish. We didn't call it country or country western. It was hillbilly music. Mm-hmm. But now we distinguish.
Mm-hmm. So how did you go about putting together, organizing the first festival in 1979, by the way?
Well, once we decided to do it, we spent a year, my wife and I spent a year studying what other outdoor venues were doing, trying to borrow their good ideas and avoid their mistakes, so to speak. And so we spent close to 2 years planning our first festival and just put all the pieces together. First of all, getting a lineup, getting the bands booked, finding out how to do that. And it was just a matter of digging into it and figuring it out. We did not go out and look for a promoter. We decided to do that ourselves. And it worked.
Well, you know, I'm curious about finding the talent to perform. How many performers did you have? How many acts did you have at that first festival?
First festival was a 2.5-day festival. It started at 6 p.m. on Friday, and we did 6 p.m. to midnight. And then Saturday, we did around noon to midnight. And Sunday, 10 to 4 or 5, something like that. Mm-hmm. So I think there were probably 15 or 16 bands that first time.
Wow.
First band that I booked was The Seldom Seen. And Dry Branch Fire Squad.
They're here this year, aren't they?
They've been here every festival. Those two bands were the first two I booked. I wanted to present both traditional bluegrass and modern bluegrass. And at that time, those two bands, in my mind, represented the goalpost between tradition and contemporary. Today, Seldom Seen is seen as very traditional, but not back then. Even though the music hasn't changed, their music hasn't changed.
So, the first festival, the first few festivals, how did it go? Any hiccups along the way, or did it go smoothly? What did you learn?
Well, we learned that we can't control the weather.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
The very first night, the very first Friday, when it was supposed to start down there on a rented stage, supposed to start at 6 o'clock, about 5 o'clock, the thunderstorms hit and it poured. The sound man was all set up to go, but he refused to turn his equipment on. He covered it up with tarps and said, I can't run in this. A local band that was on the lineup, the Adams Brothers band, Tommy Adams, he came and said, Joe, I'll run home and get my sound equipment. We'll do it in the rec hall. So we did it right here.
Yeah, that's where we are right now. We are in the rec hall.
Yep.
And even though this is a good-sized room, it's not a great-sized room for performing music.
Right. Well, that first night, the inside was totally packed, elbow to elbow. The porch was packed, and then there were people with their umbrellas around the outside listening. But we put the show on, and thanks to Tommy Adams, we were able to stay on schedule. And people liked it, and it just grew from there.
Well, it did grow when it is 40 years old, and I mean, I think it says a lot when one of the first acts that you booked has been here every year. But over the years, you have had some really big names in country and especially bluegrass. Kind of tell us how the word got out about Gettysburg and that this was a great place to come and play.
I think that our best word of mouth came from the musicians who played our show, because they liked what we were doing. Everywhere they went to play, I think they must have talked about us in positive terms. We know that that was our best word of mouth. Same with our customers, our fans that came, our ticket buyers. We know that they went back and told their friends. I don't think we could have developed the following that we did without that. I don't think any amount of advertising could have done that.
Mm-hmm. So who were some of the really big names, some of the most well-known people that have appeared here?
Well, that I have to share that with Rich, because now I've been away from the festival actively promoting it now for close to 20 years.
Oh, has it been that long?
At least 15.
Okay, all right.
So I had about 30 years, and I had some big names, but Bill Monroe, Alison Krauss, almost everybody in Bluegrass.
Just a few years ago, I interviewed Ricky Skaggs when he appeared. Rich, and I wasn't ignoring the two of you either. I was getting some history. You know, that is one of the things that a lot of people always want to know. You know, who are some of the most well-known acts that have appeared here?
Joe named a number of them. Alison Krauss, obviously, Ricky Skaggs. When he came back from country, he was a huge draw and plays here regularly. I mean, we hire him on a regular basis. And we've tapped into some other genres or maybe some bands that are just a little bit sort of outside the box, if you will. One of the first bands I ever hired was the very first band that I ever hired on my own. After I served my internship under Joe's wing, I hired the Steep Canyon Rangers. And of course they have gone on to, you know, they backed Steve Martin and Martin Short and have, you know, really become a popular sort of a cross genre band a little bit. They bring drums, which some people, you know, I mean, have certain strong feelings about when it comes to bluegrass music, but they're definitely one of the bands that I originally hired. I hired Old Crow Medicine Show in early days, and of course they've really blown up in a maybe more of what people would classify as a jam band or newgrassy kind of way, but it's really a who's who, and I mean that goes back to what Joe did in the very beginning, and I try to think about that, and I think maybe, Joe, the only two people that we've never had here that really, if you're talking about the pantheon of bluegrass and or old-time country, Doc Watson never performed here, and Flatten Scruggs never performed here.
Right. Lester
was gone.
Passed away, I think, a couple of days before our first festival.
Oh, really?
Right.
Yeah.
Or a couple of days after. I wanted him, but he was too ill to sign up for our first festival, and he passed away. And of course, Scruggs kind of went a different direction with his sons and their music. And back in those days, while I was trying to present the full spectrum of bluegrass in a balanced way, it had to be bluegrass. And Earl Scruggs got out so far that I didn't really think he was doing bluegrass clearly enough to warrant bringing him in. So I didn't, but I always regretted that.
I tried to bring him in, actually, a couple of times, just because I felt like that was somebody that should appear here.
Said pantheon of bluegrass, that's
Lester
Flatt and Earl Scruggs. I mean,
sure.
We started the
Stanley
show
Brothers
with Foggy Mountain Breakdown.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, people like Mac Wiseman.
Don't want to fail to mention Del McCurry.
Del
has played the festival off and on since the very beginning. I can't remember if he played our first festival, but very, very early. And, of course, at that time, he lived close by and was performing in this area. And he played for us many times, and we got to watch his career just explode.
Yeah, right. And the boys, too, which Cindy knew as kids because Del was here playing, and Cindy would hang out with them. We laugh about that.
I was only 10 when the first festival went on, and so I played with Ronnie and Robbie in the swimming pool in the early years.
Which is within sight.
Wait, I didn't know about that. Wait a second.
I want to talk about what is bluegrass and what is country and, you know, some of the things that you've talked about, the different genres here. I want to talk about that in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're on a Smart Talk road trip today at the Gettysburg Bluegrass Festival going on this weekend. This is one of the highlights of central Pennsylvania when it comes to music, actually in Pennsylvania as a whole. I think anyone who is into bluegrass music at all, would enjoy themselves or have enjoyed themselves here at the Gettysburg Bluegrass Festival. Our guest today during this portion of the program, Rich and Cindy Winkleman, they're the festival directors, and Joe Cornette is the original founder of the Gettysburg Bluegrass Festival in 1979, so 40 years ago that the festival started. WITF Smart Talk road trips are supported by Roof Advisory Group. You've mentioned several times, and Rich, I'll turn to you first, about the different genres of bluegrass. Joe mentioned traditional bluegrass when the festival started versus contemporary bluegrass. So here's the big question. What is bluegrass?
I guess that depends on who you ask, right? But I mean,
it's like define the universe. Right?
Define the universe. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I guess in a traditional sense, you're talking about Bill Monroe, and, you know, he's widely considered to be the godfather, if you will, of bluegrass music. So, you know, acoustic music produced with banjo, fiddle, a guitar, and an upright bass.
Acoustic, mostly.
Acoustic, yeah.
Harmony singing,
yeah. And you know, one of the things I always say about bluegrass music is that there's really no place to hide if you're in a bluegrass band. You have to be able to pick and you have to be able to sing for the most part. And, you know, you might be able to get away with one picking. And there are lots of pickers, great pickers, who don't necessarily sing, at least not lead. But there's nowhere to hide. You know, they're
very democratic, if I may interrupt. Very democratic. They take turns with their instrumental leads. They sing harmony. You don't have all of them trying to outshine the other at the same time, which is how I see some of the other popular kinds of music.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. And so, I mean, I think we're completely in agreement in that. You know, it's acoustic music that is, in my opinion, of the highest quality. The musicianship is excellent. The singing is excellent. And, you know, even in lesser known bands, the quality is pretty amazing. And so that, you know, and one of the things that I also say about bluegrass all the time is everybody's a bluegrass fan. Some people just don't know it yet. And there are lots of people, right, who have, you know, come across the genre by accident. And there's a great story that about a customer of ours, Herb Wardell, who was a military officer. Herb, how you doing, Herb, if you're out there? Who is probably in his mid-80s, I guess, at this point. Military officer who came to the campground. He was stationed down at Camp David, right? Or Fort Detrick, or...
Somewhere in Maryland,
yeah, and ended up stumbling across the campground. Well, I'm not interested in that, da-da-da. Well, the rest is history. He was at every festival up until recently when, you know, he just couldn't do it anymore. But so that's an example of, and I think that's because the genre is so compelling. And if you give it a listen and you give it a try, you know, you start to really appreciate how good they really are.
Yeah, it seems like every time they do a song, a typical bluegrass band, whether it be an amateur picker around the campfire or the guys on the gals on the stage, it seems like every time they do it, they try to do it just a little bit better than the last time. Mm.
Well, something that the two of you said, and I'm going to dig down into it a little bit more, when we talk about traditional bluegrass, and I think, again, it's one of those things a lot of people have in their mind what it is and thinking about banjo, fiddle, bass, stand-up bass, mandolin. Today, what's contemporary bluegrass? How is it different than traditional?
Song selection, for one.
Well, yeah, and that's a really good point. And one of the things that I'm always interested in when we're looking at bands is, you know, are they doing original material? You know, original songwriting, original arrangements, original instrumentation, that sort of thing is something that is compelling to me. Mm-hmm. And if it's done in the traditional way, but they're not, you know, they're not doing Foggy Mountain Breakdown over and over again,
right,
if
right,
you will. So,
right,
you know, right. that's one thing that I think defines it. And also, I mean, you got to look at Sam Bush, who
is,
you know,
here this
is here on Sunday, obviously the widely considered, the if Bill Monroe's the godfather of bluegrass, Sam and his band, Newgrass Revival, are widely credited with creating Newgrass, which, you know, is a little bit less structured maybe, and you know, doesn't follow, you know, the sort of the format of
a lot of improvisation, a lot of jamming.
Yeah, more improvisation. Yeah. So sitting around the campfire and jamming out, you know, like people do here, and then taking that to another level and creating a different version of bluegrass. I still consider it to be bluegrass music, but definitely a different style. And again,
it's hard to come up with an exact description of what is contemporary bluegrass. I mean, it's you know it when you hear it.
So it's kind of like
but it's
beauty
hard to
is in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah,
kind of like that.
Now, listen to the McCurries. I mean, that's a great example of guys that, you know, have unquestioned bones in the bluegrass world, but, you know, I have to literally drag them off the stage sometimes. I'm like, cut it out, cut it. Because they've been jamming for 2 hours.
Well, you know? If you're asking musical questions to music fans, we're promoters of the music, fans of the music, but we're not musicians.
Well, I understand. I understand.
Except it in our minds.
No, yeah. But, I mean, you have...
We're great pickers in our minds.
In the shower.
But, Rich, something you said a little while ago, I did talk to Ricky Skaggs a few years ago, and when he was appearing here, and he said to me during that interview that he can no longer consider himself country. And you said a few minutes ago, when Ricky Skaggs left country, what's the difference between country and bluegrass, and is bluegrass country?
Well, I mean, if you ask me, is bluegrass modern country and vice versa, I'd say absolutely not. I mean, I look at modern country music as pop music. And a lot of bluegrass musicians who, you know, find commercial success in the country music arena.
Well, Ricky gave up his drummer to go from his country to his bluegrass. He gave up his drummer. He gave up his electric guitarist. He reduced the size of his band slowly over time to get down to a typical bluegrass 5-6 maybe. He still has a large band, at least the last time I saw
him. Yeah, he's but, 6 or 7 guys backing him.
But those instruments that pedal steel, I am not sure if Ricky had pedal steel in his country days.
A pedal steel guitar, yeah.
I wasn't paying that much attention then, but typically, that's what it is.
And drums,
been other
too.
Bands right. that have come back.
Part of the Ken Burns documentary that will be on WYTF and PBS next month, one of the real keys to country music, and I think it holds true with bluegrass too, is the storytelling aspect of it. You mentioned modern country. One thing that Ricky said to me at that time is, I don't drive a pickup truck. I don't drink. I'm with my wife. Now, that not every country song has that, but there are a lot of modern country that is the theme of a lot of modern country, and that's not a negative. I mean, there are a lot of people who that's one of the reasons they enjoy it. But bluegrass, as a storytelling, is kind of the same thing. And Rich, when you say that you look for talent that has their own original material. Bluegrass, again, like country, there are a lot of stories in it.
Well, yeah, there's stories about taking your ex down to the river and that kind of thing.
We need Ron Thomason up here right
we
now.
We need your end. Yeah, well, that's a great example of a storyteller, a consummate storyteller. But, you know, I mean, bluegrass, I always laugh. You know, there's stories about love and hate and murder and taking your ex to the river and throwing her in, that kind of hymn, whatever the case may be.
I haven't heard that one.
Oh, they're out there, believe me.
Cindy, maybe you better worry about this.
We're still together.
All right. As long as you don't take it to the river.
No, no. But, you know, I mean, you know, I think traditionally country and bluegrass were the same in the sense that they told those kinds of stories, and they told stories about the stuff that they knew, you know, which was
true life story.
Working hard, right. And right. You know, down at the mine, and the train coming around the track delivering the mail, and you know, things that they were, that was their everyday life. They were familiar with those kinds of things, and they wrote songs and they sang about them, and that was just part and parcel of who those folks were that, you know, really developed it.
And I think some of the entertainers just happened to be good storytellers, good conversationalists. I mean, Ron Thomason, the leader of the Dry Branch Fire Squad, is the consummate storyteller. And he can tell you the simplest story about something that happened or that he imagined. So simple, but you can laugh till your side split over it because he's so good at telling stories. But they're stories about simple everyday life.
I don't have
that talent.
Well, I was going to say, that is one of the signs of a talented songwriter, storyteller,
right.
Is that the simplest thing they can make into something that's interesting and compelling. But, you know, one of the keys here is not just being a talented storyteller, but being able to put it to music.
Well.
And music that, you know, gets people's attention, and they hear the story, they hear the music. It's just one, the whole thing right there.
Right.
I think you just defined bluegrass music.
I think you're right.
It only took us 45 minutes to do that. So, Cindy, you, as you said, you grew up with this. Mm-hmm. You told me before the program that you're involved on the business side for the most part. But as an observer and then someone who is involved in it intimately, what changes have you seen, first of all, with the festival and with the music over the years?
Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure.
But, I mean, okay, you're 10 years old playing in the pool with the McCrory boys, mm-hmm. Which there's a song there somewhere, by the way.
When she and her sister were young teenagers, we learned a few years later that they sneaked out of the farmhouse after Mom and I went to bed. They sneaked out of the farmhouse and went around listening to the pickers in the campground.
That's so funny. There actually haven't been a lot of changes over the years. No, not with the festival itself. We've been
we've been pretty much in a rut since I was in a rut since 79.
Well,
now the kids have I think
we built a new stage. How about that?
They've added some new flavor, but
well, consistency is a good thing.
There's a lot of changes with the campground business, so the camping side of things. But in terms of the festival and the music and what we do, we've just been trying to stick to.
Well, granted, the bands change. We have new bands coming up every year, and some bands retire. So they both, all of us have over the years mixed it up with the show, but the festival itself, the format has remained the same.
So,
I mean, what's it like working as a family on an event like this?
Oh, it's fun.
Is it?
It's a barrel of monkeys, right? We don't fight at all. No, you know what? I often give Joe a lot of credit for having developed something like this and producing 50 shows is, I think, what I came up with when I was thinking about
54.
It. 54. Was it 54?
That's right.
Whatever.
Anyway. We'll share those for
you. But I give them a lot of credit because obviously if you do something for that long, you're vested and, you know, it's your baby. And for him to turn it over to me, his erstwhile campground owner / bluegrass promoter son-in-law was...
Wow, that's a long business card.
He's done a good job. He's done a great job.
We've been trying to sustain what he built and do it in a similar fashion. I mean, formulaically speaking, it's similar to what Joe did. We've made some changes along the way. We built a big stage, which obviously was a big change for us. But generally, you know, the fact that he was willing to turn that over and let us run with it and carry on the tradition, the torch, it's kind of like bluegrass, you know, music. We're carrying the torch forward and trying to get people to, you know, get involved in the music and sustain it and introduce people to something that we both all are passionate about and think is a very important thing that needs to be presented and promoted. So,
Cindy, how many people do you expect this weekend?
A couple thousand people over the course of the weekend.
A couple, 2,000?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 2,500.
That first year, how many did you get? Do you remember?
Oh, boy. I remember talking to Charlie Waller, the leader of the Country Gentlemen. They played our first show. And that area in front of the stage looked like it was packed to me. And I know that we had been struggling to get through the gate. We were kind of disorganized. And we didn't have time to count money. It was just in a tub. We didn't know. But I looked out at the audience, and I was talking to Charlie, and I said, Charlie, how many people do you think are out there? And I was hoping he would say 5,000 or something like that. He said, Joe, man, that's a good crowd. You have 700 or 800 people out there. And my heart just went down like that.
Well, 2,500 is a big difference now. Hey, I want to thank the three of you for being with us today. Rich and Cindy Winkleman, the Gettysburg Bluegrass Festival directors. Joe Cornett was the original founder of the Bluegrass Festival in 1979. Thank you very much for having us here and all the enjoyment you're going to give the people who are going to be here this weekend. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks,
thank you for coming.
We really appreciate it.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
Bear that heavy load. This is where the river meets the sea. This is where the fire burns within. This is where you fit in your own skin. This is when you get down on your knees. Ain't nobody all alone. We're all made of flesh and bone. There's one thing you've got to see, that no matter where you roam, we're all just heading home. One day
welcome back to Smart Talk. Yes, you don't normally hear bluegrass music during the course of a Smart Talk program, but today's kind of a unique program and really a great program today. We're coming to you live this Smart Talk road trip from the Gettysburg Bluegrass Festival. And Smart Talk road trips, by the way, are supported by Roof Advisory Group. Making waves on the bluegrass charts, Lancaster County-based Colebrook Rhodes' new album and single, On Time, reached number 3 on the Bluegrass Today Airplay chart, and the album was number 8 on the Billboard Contemporary Bluegrass chart. This award-winning group of accomplished musicians has become a standout string band, a bluegrass powerhouse made up of 5 individuals whose sum is more than the total of their talents. And all 5 members of Colebrook Rhodes are with us today. I'm going to have you introduce yourselves, and it's radio, so I'll describe it. We're going left to right here. So, who are you and your name?
I'm Wade Yankee. I play the mandolin in the band.
I'm Jesse Ice and Bice. I play the guitar and do most of the songwriting.
Okay.
Mark Rest. I play the banjo.
I'm Jeff Campbell, and I do the high harmony vocals and upright bass.
Say your name again. I think you're
Mike. Jeff Campbell.
Okay, Jeff. There you go.
And I'm Joe McAnulty. I'm the fiddle player and baritone singer.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program, it's an honor to be able to talk to you. You actually performed... I don't know if it performed or recorded is the right way to say it, at the WITF studios for our WITF music project. Gettysburg Bluegrass Festival, what does it mean playing here?
It's really important to me personally, and I think it has been for the whole band. This is actually the first Bluegrass Festival I was ever at, maybe 15 or so years ago. I heard Joe and Rich talking about Charlie Waller, and I think it was the last year that he was here. So this has sort of always been bluegrass to me.
Were you into bluegrass before coming to the festival, or did the festival kind of lead you to bluegrass, or maybe solidified your love of bluegrass?
Yeah, I kind of just had gotten into bluegrass. I was living in West Virginia at the time and was just home visiting. I'm from close to here, and I didn't even know this festival existed, and my dad actually told me it was going on, and I just drove down here sort of on a whim one day.
So Lancaster County based, where in Lancaster County are you from?
Well, half these guys are from Lancaster City, and the other half of us are pretty close to Harrisburg, so we're Dauphin County / Lancaster County.
Colebrook Road, for those that don't know, Colebrook Road, of course, Colebrook near Mount Gretna, which is in Lebanon County, but is, I'm assuming Colebrook Road, you got your name from that, correct?
Yep, from Route 341 is where I grew up.
There you go.
Right through Dauphin County and Lebanon County.
That goes into Colebrook, and about 341 doesn't reach Mount Gretna. Talk about your very first meeting in the jam that sparked the idea for Colebrook Road.
This is Jesse. I was living in back here in Central PA after kind of living all over the West Coast, and there was an online forum some folks may remember called MySpace. And one of our classmates from Lower Dauphin High School, class of 99, which Wade and I both graduated from, said, "Hey, you should look each other up. Both like bluegrass." So he came over to the house, and he knew a bunch of fiddle tunes, and I knew like one, and just started picking. Became reacquainted after that.
Yeah, and then Jesse moved away for a little while to Montana, and ended up moving back, and we went to see the fellas earlier also mentioned the Steep Canyon Rangers.
Yes.
And we had gone out to see them, and we were like, we really need to find some people to play and start a band. And I met Marcus Weaver, our first banjo player, at a Super Bowl party, and I drug him to a jam at Jesse's house the next couple weeks. And right.
So what is a jam? I've heard, I mean, we have that, I mean, what a lot of people probably picture are musicians sitting around, whether it's here at the campground, at a campfire, but in a garage, in a backyard. What's a jam?
Well, I think there's kind of a standard canon of songs in the bluegrass and the old time world. And a jam is where a lot of people know a few of the songs, and you get together and you play together and you share licks and you maybe create new versions of a standard song. And it's just a lot of fun.
So what are some of those standard bluegrass songs that everyone knows?
A lot of fiddle tunes. I think some of the Bill Monroe stuff. Jerusalem Ridge, and then the old time songs, Salt Creek and Cherokee Shuffle and Blackberry Blossom and things like that. And then old standard songs to sing, like what, Jesse?
Oh, like Rolling My Sweet Baby's Arms, 9-Pound Hammer. Yeah. Usually we call that at a jam low-hanging fruit. If you call one of those out, most folks can at least jump in some form or another.
Rolling My Sweet Baby Arms, who wrote that?
Oh, geez, Mark, wow. I don't know.
I'm not sure.
The version that I think everybody knows is the Flattened Scruggs version.
All right, yeah, that's kind of what
I mean. A lot of the tunes came out of the old-time country tradition, which kind of predated bluegrass, and a lot of them are public domain. A lot of Carter Family songs come up and through that. So.
Yeah, and at this point, I will mention that next month on WITF-TV, Ken Burns' country music documentary looks at a lot of that history that derived from Appalachia, and with the Carter family and Bill Monroe with the, you know, some of the pioneers of bluegrass. But a lot of that music, if someone hears it today for the first time, say, well, that's bluegrass music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As opposed to country music. When did the two divide? Or have they?
Well, I think they definitely did. Now, when, I'm not sure. I mean, bluegrass sort of came into a formal existence in the 40s, but... I don't know when they really divided. I feel like it was still part of the country music world for a while. Mm-hmm. But they probably divided in the, not so long after that, in the 50s or 60s, it kind of split.
Do you guys consider yourself bluegrass / country?
I would say yes. I think we call ourselves a progressive bluegrass band.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when Bill Monroe started with his band, the name of his band was the Bluegrass Boys, right? Two words, blue space grass. Mm-hmm. And it was just a form of country music. And it wasn't until later after that that the genre was named one word, bluegrass, named after the band, who was named after, obviously, the bluegrass state, Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that it was necessarily a genre when he was doing it. It was just a style of country music at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one of the things that we talked about a little bit earlier on the program was the storytelling aspect of it. when I ask when, I'm not looking for an exact date, but when did you start writing your own material, performing your own material, getting away from that low-hanging fruit, as you described it?
I would say right off the bat, when we first got together, I had a few originals. And one of them that we're going to play here today at the festival called Coyote. We've been playing that since the very beginning, and so it's been a pretty popular one for us. So I think that was what set us apart, you know, right off the bat, was playing original tunes. You know, we wanted to get away from a lot of those songs that you've heard over and over again.
Although I know the audience probably from time to time is looking for those kind of traditional songs, but they also enjoy, and then that's what sets bands apart, is when their original material is really good and the audience appreciates it.
Well, and you can also take original material and make it sound a little bit like the traditional material. And that's a real treat. As when I go out and listen to bands, I want to hear something new. And when the new connects the old, that's like just gets it. And I think that's what the Steep Canyon Rangers really did when they first started. They were something new, but it was deeply rooted in tradition.
Jessica, I see you nodding your head. It's behind. It's kind of we don't normally have five microphones on the program. So, Jesse, right?
Jeff,
I'm sorry. Jesse's over here. Okay, Jeff, I saw you nodding your head vigorously when we were talking about that.
I was just kind of thinking about what Mark was saying, where originals kind of sound like. I like hearing a song, you're like, man, that has to be a cover. That has to be like 100 years old. No, it's brand new. It was written 3 months ago. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a trip when I hear a song like that. I really enjoy that.
Now, do the five of you contribute to the songwriting process?
Yes.
Yeah, Jesse writes the bulk of the material we do, especially the vocal songs. But I think everybody contributes to the arrangements, and we've all written some instrumental music that we play.
So, again, with country, with bluegrass, the storytelling aspect, how much, where do you get your motivation? Where do you come up with the stories that you tell in your songs?
It's kind of varying themes, but, you know, a lot of stuff comes back to growing up around here. I mean, we have a song about the Conewago Creek. You know, we have some stuff about growing up on a farm in Dauphin County, things like that. So it's just the experiences of living in central PA. It's obviously not a hotbed of bluegrass. You know, none of us are from North Carolina or Kentucky. So we sort of have a unique spin on that, I think. It's you know, if you hear our sound, it's a little bit different than everybody else, but you can still hear the bluegrass sounds.
Jeff, when you travel outside of Pennsylvania, and maybe there are groups that are from North Carolina or Kentucky, do they look down on a Pennsylvania bluegrass group?
No, they don't look down on it. I mean, they might poke fun at our accents. We're the only band on our label from north of the Mason-Dixon line. No, they don't look down at it at all. I mean,
that was the wrong way to put it, but I mean, do they think differently of you?
No, I don't think so. Like, as soon as they hear we have chops and we can sing and, you know, we're playing the same music they are, it's just got a slightly different flavor to it. Yeah, everyone respects everyone else as long as you can hold your own.
Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Oh, no, I was just agreeing with
Jesse. You said that you have a song about the Conewago Creek. What are some other themes from central Pennsylvania that you've put into your music?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Do you have a Three Mile Island
about Coyote
song?
Susquehanna River song.
Yeah, that's right. We have one called The Shallow River Blues about the Susquehanna getting real low and dry this time of year, which, you know, it hasn't for the last couple years, but typically does. Yeah, the one I mentioned earlier, Coyote, is kind of about the preservation of farmland in Dauphin and Lancaster County. And, you know, just other stuff, imagery of, you know, the hardwood forests of Pennsylvania, that sort of thing.
In the Ken Burns documentary, the songwriter Harlan Howard said country music, and I'm going to say this with bluegrass too, ask the same question. He said three chords and the truth. Is it?
I think it comes from a lot of life experience. Like we were saying, like Jesse gets out in nature a whole lot, and a lot of his themes come from that, and growing up on a farm and doing that. But it's a really, and I think any genre of music that you're writing songs and telling a story has some of that influence into it, you know.
What comes first, the music or the lyrics?
Depends on who writes the song.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. I think it's from the experiences. Like, I grew up playing melodies all the time and not playing songs as a classical musician. So the melody always came first for me. And the chords and everything else, you know, came behind it and figuring that stuff out. And I think, you know, everyone has a different experience with it.
Well, the five of you, one of the things that is unique about bluegrass, besides the string instruments, is the harmonies, the vocal harmonies. How long did it take the five of you to get together and be able to harmonize?
I think we work on it every week.
It's really?
One of the things that we...
10 years.
Yeah, 10 years. and we'll see how it goes this afternoon.
the noon sets are always the toughest.
Yeah. Why is that?
Oh, it takes a while for the vocal cords to warm up.
Really?
Yeah. Although this interview will help things. So we appreciate that.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to do something here. Okay, no instruments. Harmonize a verse for me. Can you do that?
I don't know. We don't have a pitch pipe or a guitar or anything over here to give us.
All right, I know I'm putting you on the spot here, but...
I can go get one of the mandolins.
Yeah, quick.
Yeah, somebody give us a mandolin.
I think you might have to wait till we get on stage here in a couple
All
hours.
Right, okay. Well, somebody's running back there for a mandolin. No, but
Dan will get us a mandolin.
So you need the music to go along with it.
Well, it's good to have a reference pitch.
It's not like you're a barbershop quartet.
Even those guys start with a pitch pipe, though.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Okay, so thank you very much for the mandolin. We don't know who it belongs to, but thank you very much. You're reaching into your pocket.
Thanks to the good people at Eastman for letting me borrow this mandolin. we're running out of time, I think, though.
No, we got about 3 minutes. What do you want
to do? I don't sing, so I'm getting off real easy here.
Okay.
So
No, we don't want to do it. Okay. All right. You can play the mandolin if you want.
That's right. We were told we were only talking in this interview.
All right. Well, that just popped into my mind. I'm sorry about that. I put you on the spot.
That's all right.
So,
I can go back to the three chords and the truth thing too.
Okay. All right. All
another
right.
way to part of, that can connect with the jam thing. The three chords makes the music very accessible, and people. It's easy to learn. I mean, we go way past the three chords, but that accessibility of the music really creates some of the popularity and the reason everybody's a bluegrass fan, they just might not know it yet.
Mm-hmm. What about the truth? That. What about the truth?
The truth, the lyrics cut straight to the heart. Bill Monroe used to talk about the ancient tones, so the music has the ancient tones and the words have the ancient themes. And putting that all together makes it very accessible.
Your current album is On Time. Themes, inspiration, songwriting. Tell me a little bit about the album.
As far as the songwriting, you know, a lot of that is just our experience after doing this for 10 years and, you know, making some transitions to do this much more than we have before. For example, next week we're traveling out to the West Coast to play a week in Oregon, Washington, you know, where we first started, it was basically just Dauphin and Lancaster County. So it's kind of a reflection of all that stuff and the music and how much we've grown as musicians just being together for all this time. You know, most bands that we see on the circuit, the festival circuit, have different members every year that we see them. And, you know, I think a big reflection of this album is all the time that we spent together playing music.
Where'd the title come from, On Time?
That one was a song that I wrote about how it seemed like a year or two ago we were just always fighting the clock. You know, everybody working 40, 50 hours a week and still going to play all the time, 50 or 60 dates a year. And it seemed like everywhere we went, especially the Pennsylvania Turnpike, we were just always barely making it on time.
You need to write a song about construction.
we're still doing that. Yep, tomorrow morning we're heading on 76 West out to Somerset. Yep.
Well, I want to thank the five of you for being on here today. Cole Brook Road and had their new album out On Time. We'll be performing. What time are you performing today?
We're playing at noon and six.
Yeah. Okay, Heather. I'll get that. I got whispered in my ears. But again, I want to thank the five of you for being with us and good luck and whatever you're doing. You guys are on the road to success. By the way, you can see a video performance of Colebrook Road on WITF Music. Go to our website, WITF.org. Gentlemen, again, thank you very much for being with us today.
Our pleasure.
Also wanted to mention that coming up as part of our country music, WITF Music Project, to extend the reach of the country music, Ken Burns documentary will be at the Storyteller Session event coming up September 8th at the American Music Theater in Lancaster. So keep that on your calendar, and we'd like to see you at that as well. Coming up on Monday's program on Smart Talk, we are going to be talking about, let's see, what do we have coming up on Monday's program? Invasive species here in Pennsylvania. Have yourself a good day.